Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. We have another very busy show, and in just a little bit, we'll be joined by David Wright Filade. He might be our first three-peat. I got to triple check this, but he might be our first three-peat. He's an amazing guy. He does young adult, he does nonfiction, he does historical fiction, and he teaches. And his book, The New Internationals, has just come out in paperback. He's wonderful. But first, Claude is doing the important work just kind of incognito this evening, so you won't hear his dulcet tones a lot. David Aldridge, of course. David, we've got to quickly recap Final Four and the Masters. Our dear friend Jim Grady, the icon, and our favorite mayor, Judd Ashman. Mm-hmm. So we'll do mayor.
Glad to be here.
Mr. Mayor, how are you?
I'm doing great. I've been burning the candle at both ends. I'm running for higher office currently, and it's all encompassing.
So great. What is your campaign like?
In fact, let me level set here a little bit. Usually, I am a sports fan. I watch sports, but I have had no time to do it. I've had very little time to read books. So I expect this to be my least effective podcast with you guys ever. So let me just set the bar very low.
We've got a pretty low bar, Judd. It'll be fine. What is campaigning like? What's your what do you do? Do you go door to door? Are you social media? What's your thing?
Yes, door to door, because I'm running in a district where you can do that. Mm-hmm. And social media, all of the above, social media, candidate forums, fundraisers, meet and greets. It's just one thing to the next.
And what do you think of the hot, little campaigning here? What are the hot button issues for your people?
Right now it's taxes, because in Montgomery County, they're proposing raising taxes again for the sixth time in the last 8 years with this county executive, and people have had a lot. It's already not that affordable in Montgomery County, and this could make it worse. And so people are worried about it, but then the trade-off is, well, if you don't raise taxes, then you have to cut services. As wise people have said, the answer to all your questions is money, right?
Mm-hmm. Often is. Okay, speaking of, and taxes.
It's college. You like a nice four-room dorm? You got to pay for it.
You sure do.
Right?
GW, somebody told me the other day, is over $90,000 a year.
It's going to be $98,000 a year next year at GW. $98,000.
Holy cow.
That's almost 15 times more than the 4-year state university I went to.
Yeah.
And it just I think it took like at most $1,700 a year to get through my university. Yeah. And it was a great university. It just
Jim, I was out of state at NC State, and I think it was $2,500 a year, maybe $2,800 a year. Yeah. I saw a friend last night yesterday at the hockey game. Great hockey game, by the way. And her daughter is in, I think, ninth grade, maybe 10th grade, and she rides horses, and she's being recruited. She wants to do NCAA, and she's being recruited. And 5 or 10 years ago, I would have said to you, no, don't. Like, if you've been into horses for a long time, which this young lady has, she's very good, then just go to college and have fun or whatever. And now I'm like, yes, get recruited, get a full ride, get all the great swag.
Yeah.
You can always transfer after 2 years if you want. That's insane.
Yeah. And there's no money available for out-of-state tuition, out-of-state residents. There's nothing. It doesn't matter what you...
Does D.C. no longer, David, D.C., this is chatter on education, everybody. Does D.C. used to have a thing if you were a D.C. resident?
They still do. It's 10 grand.
Yeah. Does that help? How much?
It helps unless you go to a school that's $98,000 a year. Okay. Now it's $88,000.
It's not worth it. It's not worth it. Oh, my God. Okay. So we're going to do a quick recap. This time last week, we were watching the Final Four and watching Michigan go blue win, which is Very exciting. And I will use this opportunity again to apologize to the Duke fans, about whom I've pointed out exactly who you are and what you're like. But last Friday, I drove to Columbus, Ohio, saw our dear friend Mike Crowley, who says hi to everybody, doing some work with Claude. And then the next morning, our son Charlie flew in to Columbus, and because he went to Michigan, and he and I drove to Indianapolis for the two semifinal games. Mm-hmm. And the semifinal games are always the best games anyhow. And here are, where you're all over town and you're going into bars and there's a fan fest and all this stuff. And here are Arizona fans and Illinois fans and UConn fans and Michigan fans. And everyone was nice. Everyone was nice. And it's like, hey, I mean, the running joke was see you Monday night, you know, that kind of thing. But if the Duke fans had been there, it would have been a completely different scene. And you could, you're in a packed bar standing in line to buy your son and his 20-something friends a round of shots, and which is why I was allowed to go because I was buying the beers and shots.
Money bag.
Yeah.
Why, that's the parents get to hang out with their 20-somethings.
Exactly. Exactly. But you, all you had to do was, if somebody was wearing Illinois gear or Arizona gear or whatever, just say, oh, aren't you glad Duke's not here? You got a 10-minute conversation. So that was great. Great hockey game yesterday. My Ovechkin, a lot of people came to the last home game of the season at Cap One yesterday, expecting this to be the last home game for Ovechkin, that he will retire. I don't think he's going to. I think he's going to come back next year. David first, then Judd, then Jim. What's your bet, David?
I don't know Alex Ovechkin at all, so I would not pretend to have any insight into what he's going to do. I know that he has said that he would actually like to retire playing for Moscow Dynamo, which is the team of his youth. Mm-hmm. When he was growing up in Russia, that was his favorite team, and that he would like to do that. And so I suspect, having no information whatsoever, that mm-hmm. that's what he will do. Now, will it be next year or the year after? I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, Judd?
Yeah, I'm just playing the odds. David has much, I mean, even though he's caveated this pretty good, he's a sports writer, and I'm not. And so I'm just going with David.
Judd's going to caveat this whole show, I can tell. Whole show. Okay, Jim, what's your bet?
My sense is, I'm with David. On the other hand, I kind of doubt that he'll want to retire. I mean, he's still doing pretty good.
Pretty good.
You know, yeah. And so when he retires, where is he going to go and what is he going to do?
Yeah.
Maybe go back to Moscow and play for, you know, whatever, or take over a coaching job. But he's in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And yeah. And he's not. He's got the one record, but he could go for the overall record where it's regular season and playoff goals. He's not that far off. I think it's 14, 15 goals, something like that.
Could do that. I think the big one was Gretzky, though. I think that was.
Yeah, the big one was Gretzky, but this is another one. And to Jim's point, he, without a lot of effort, he had a pretty good season this year. They just have to push him out on the ice occasionally.
It's never the games. They know how to, they can play till they're 50. It's the preparation that always gets makes people retire, because you have to work so hard to keep your body in shape, to never, you know, to push it through small injuries. And it's just all the stuff you have to do, the weight training, everything you have to do all the time, every day, day after day, week after week. That's why guys retire, because it just gets too hard. It gets
and he
too
really,
hard.
It was, I'm going to lose track, but I think it was probably before 2018 when they won the Stanley Cup. A couple years before that, he said, okay, I got to get serious about this. If we're going to win it, you know, now's the time. And it was a huge, huge, huge effort.
Sure. And, you know, I think we all know Alex likes to have a beverage every once in a while. You have to kind of cut back on that.
Okay. Here was the sign yesterday. So they're playing the Penguins, the much hated Pittsburgh Penguins. And game's over. Caps win 3-0. And all the Penguins come out in the ice because they're going to shake hands with Ovechkin, who they're assuming is not going to be.
Yeah.
Is going to be retiring. And he just waved them off.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not there yet. Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't know. I really do think he doesn't know yet. He hasn't really thought about it yet.
I agree.
He didn't want to shake their hands.
Or he
didn't want to shake their hands.
Both things could be true, right?
Yeah. It's somebody who had to give up on the Penguins long ago. I could see that. Mm-hmm. Okay. From one great accomplishment to another, I'm going to read everybody a blurb I read recently about Jim's upcoming book, Shadows on Sidewalks. This was from the Library Journal. And Jim's coming back in early May to talk about his book. Grady's unforgettable novel features a presciently cynical protagonist who must outwit the minds of an amoral family. Grady's latest work is skillfully executed. It features all the hallmarks of a modern-day noir novel, brimming with smart dialogue, femme fatales, I think that's the plural, and the shady dealings of the wealthy and powerful. Not bad, Jim.
I know. That made my day, you know. It's
yeah, they don't often write them like your mom would, but that's pretty good.
No, that getting as I'm sure is well known by all of you, the day you get a good review is wonderful. But the day you get a great review like that one, I just grinned the whole morning that I found out about it from my editor.
Did they hit the important things, in your opinion?
I wouldn't say they missed a thing. You know, it's like they're excellent. it was just a great review,
and I'm good. Congrats.
Thank you. And thank you for mentioning this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then you're coming back in early May, so we can talk about it more. And I have it. I have a copy. Okay. Mayor Judd Ashman, in addition to campaigning, you're also busy keeping eyes on the Gaithersburg Book Festival coming up in May. Give us the debrief.
Debrief. Okay. Gaithersburg Book Festival coming up on Saturday, May 16th, with more than 130 of some of the world's best authors speaking about their latest work, signing books, and a special appearance of Tori Clark, who will be interviewing Jason Mott, winner of the National Book Award. I think it was in 2020 when he won. And he also, before that, he's been in our festival before. He had a book called The Return that was adapted into an ABC series. Yeah. So he's a pretty cool guy. He's got a new book called People Like Us. We have this year's, the latest National Book Award winner. His name's Ravi Alamuddin. And the book is called The True Story of Raja the Gullible. And I've started reading the book, and it's very, very funny. But I have not finished it because I'm busy politicking. So I'm embarrassed to say we have a panel, two Washington Post journalists, Carol Leonig and Aaron Davis, have a book called Injustice: How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. Between them, I think there's seven or eight Pulitzer Prizes. I'm not even kidding. Between those two, I think it's our most Pulitzer heavy panel that we've ever had at GBF. So I'm happy about that. Some other highlights, Lori Frankel, who's a perennial bestseller. We have this author named Ayanna Gray, who has written teen YA books a lot and has done well, but she's written an adult book that's a twist on mythology. It's called I, Medusa. And it's like, when we put it on social media,
I've heard about this.
People were really excited about this book. Sadiqua Johnson, who's been on this show before.
Great.
Susan Page, who's been on this show before. She's got a book, The Queen and Her Presidents. George Packer, whose writing I love. He writes for The Atlantic. And then some amazing children's authors, Aaron and Trotta Kelly, Linda Sue Park, Tony Keith Jr., John Patrick Green. With Artemis II being a tremendous success, we have a former astronaut children's author named Leland Melvin, who's coming.
That's great.
Who we're excited about. And Sarah Dessen is a great teen YA writer. So it's a really, really great lineup of authors. It's Saturday, May 16th. It is free to attend and free to park. And you can find out all the details at GaithersburgBookFestival.org.
It is really, really something. If you've never been, people, it is worth the trip to Gaithersburg. If you're anywhere within, 100, 200 miles, it is a great event. I will never get over being so struck by how many young people were there, which is really, really nice. And the variety of events. There are workshops, there are kids events, anything anybody wants remotely related to the literary world is there. Jim, you were there, right?
Oh,
about
yeah.
10 years? Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's one of the best literary festivals of its kind. I mean, I am like, it astounds me, how wonderful it is. And you know, I know that there's events in New York City and Chicago and other places, but Gaithersburg stands equal to, and dare I say this, maybe a little better than some of the higher level, quote, higher level and better known events.
The check is in the mail. Thank you.
Really well done. It's really
Judd, how has it changed over the years? You've been the godfather for this.
It's really just, it's grown. It used to be on a smaller, it used to have a smaller footprint. We changed its location because it outgrew it. It's really about the scale. We have more authors, we have more food trucks, we have more exhibits, that sort of stuff. So, but the concept, the flagship program, is largely the same. What changes every year are the stories that are told. That's what changes.
Didn't we just and you have a fantastic team. They are so organized. Well, David, we'll be at the Gaithersburg. I'll be at the Gaithersburg Book Festival that Saturday.
Yes.
And then we'll be, you should text us if you have any cute, tearful photos of your son graduating. That'd be so great.
I will. Yep, that weekend. So yes, I will send photos.
Are you staying down there? Do you have a, where are you staying?
Oh, yeah.
Hard to get.
It's like a 4-day event. It's not like it used to be where it's 2 hours and you're done. It's like a week of stuff.
Yeah. Well, our featured author went away. He was, there he is.
Where is he?
Back in the middle of my screen.
Yeah, Claude moved him over. It's like the Brady Bunch.
It's like, what was that game? Remember the little plastic? It was like a little square. It was plastic, had little tiles, and you had to keep moving them around.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Rubik's Cube, right?
That was too hard for me, Jim.
Yeah, that was a word game. I can't remember. I know what you're talking about. Yes.
Black and white tiles. Okay.
Yeah.
David Wright Falade. And you're going to tell me if I'm pronouncing your name correctly this time, because I struggle.
It's Falade like holiday.
Okay, that's how I've been saying in the past, and I was corrected by someone. Okay, David Wright Falade, welcome back. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Great to see you again. I know you know David Aldridge, and I'm not sure. I don't think, Judd, have you met David before?
No. Okay. Nice to meet you. It's an honor.
It's great to meet you.
You should get to know each other. When Judd's not running for something, he'll have more time to devote to books and things like that. And our local icon, James Grady. So thank you for being with us.
What
have you been up to, David?
Working on a new project and then just sort of living life and teaching classes and, you know, doing what you have to do to, keep moving forward, I suppose.
I was ticking through some stuff and I was reminding, I was going back through your bio again and reading stuff. And I thought, okay, he does young adult, he does nonfiction, he does historical fiction, and he teaches. How long have you been teaching now?
This is my 25th year at the University of Illinois, and I taught for a few years before that at a small college. So it's been a while. Yeah, I'm starting to feel it.
What's changed the most?
That's a great question. And part of this is probably a response to this moment, and I think how we're all maybe anxious about AI and technology. Wow. But really that. This was maybe a year ago, but I was in New York, and I was talking to my agent, and he was mentioning, we were having lunch, like one of those, sort of stereotypical, prototypical kind of agent client lunches that you dream about. And I was having it with him. But at the end, we weren't talking about workbook things, but he asked that question. He said he had read, I think it was in The Atlantic, actually, an article about how students don't read, aren't reading anymore. And that, I think, is the biggest change. We talked about it a little bit before, I think, but it's striking me even more and more, particularly now with AI. I was thinking about it the other day in a different context. It's rare that I assign a whole book, It's rare that I assign an entire book. And that's shocking, even to me, who's the person who's, charged with teaching them to read and take this on. But it's just a challenge. And I was teaching an honors class a year ago, even in that class, and they were super engaged, but it was clear that it would be a challenge to sort of keep a pace like I had 25 years ago when I first arrived at the U of I. And it was not a book a week, but it was close and a lot, so.
And they just say, no, just don't have the time. We just don't have the time to do that.
They don't say no, but they're not responsive. Like you can tell when the discussions flag and things like that, when they're not doing well on the assignments, not necessarily because they're not engaged, but because they're not able to sort of engage in that way with the texts. And so we have to focus on smaller chunks of texts and go slower. And over the years, that's just led to fewer and fewer texts. And ultimately, I started rethinking how to be able to cover as much of the same material, but in other ways than sort of just like, you know, here is this list of books. So,
yeah. It's a frequent flyer back in the day of Cliff's Notes. Hands up. Who else had Cliff's Notes? Yeah. And I was always struggling with it was Cliff's plural.
I did not. I couldn't do it.
You couldn't? Oh, David, you're such a good person.
No, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it.
So you read absolutely everything?
No, that's not true. But okay. I would just take the B minus or the C plus because I was like, my parents got me here so I could actually try to learn something.
I probably told the story in the show, but my high school, my all-time worst, Tori's just a total slack off and does not take things seriously. Had an amazing English teacher, and I'm not really sure what the assignment was, but I swear to God, I decided that my essay was going to be writing about using Lord Jim, the book, to explain Jungian philosophy.
Wow.
If you held a gun to my head right now, I could not explain to you Jungian philosophy, Lord Jim, any of it. And I swear to God, what gave me the inspiration is I had seen the movie Lord Jim with Peter O'Toole, who in the day had the most killer cheekbones on screen. Just killer. It's a little like Cillian Murphy today. Hmm. Anyways, so somehow I'm writing this thing, and I never finished the book. And so it's 3 o'clock in the morning, papers due at 9 o'clock in the morning, like feverishly typing. And I'm waking up my mother going, what happens at the end? What happens at the end? The best thing is about 10 years ago, I swear to God, I told this story. 10 years ago, I'm digging through boxes and I found the paper and I had gotten an A on it from a really, really tough teacher, probably my only A in high school. And I'm reading it going, and I swear to God, you guys, I didn't understand a sentence of it. It was like some weird thing had overcome. And it was so unlike everything else I did, which was largely fueled by Cliff's Notes. Cliff Notes. Okay. All right. David Wright, Holiday rhymes with holiday. How do you find time when you're teaching to write all these wonderful books? What's your schedule like? How do you organize yourself?
Thank you. You know, I'm fairly disciplined. And a lot of that, you know, came from like football. You just have to do this and this time and you make these spaces. I also don't have children. And so I just organize my days just from like for the past 30 years, where typically the first, I'm a morning person and typically it's just the first thing I do in the morning. I also, I'm knocking on wood when I say this, like I'm fortunate. It took me a while to sort of figure out that this would be advantageous for me and then to be able to sort of work it out. But my teaching schedule at the university favors it too. I do the bulk of my teaching in one semester. In the second semester, it's a little bit lighter so that even though I'm engaged, I can sort of create more spaces of time. So I have these, gotcha. I need blocks of time. And the blocks of time I do, you know, sort of January through August.
Yeah. Jim Gray, what's your organizational structure for writing?
Well, I've always been a morning person too. And I think that I can't remember a far better author than me talked about how you want to get up and when you are fresh, have those voices telling you what to do. So I've always, even when I was working as a muckraker or in the U.S. Senate, I would get up around 6 and I still get up around 6:30 and I work really until around 3. Now there's a point when I was in my 20s and, you know, I'd already been a fairly successful author and I living in my by myself. And I would get up and I would work really hard all morning long after taking a big run. And then I'd come back and I'd work hard in the afternoon. And I realized that about mid-afternoon, around 3 o'clock, I could convince myself that I was becoming a genius. And I would just, that what I was working on from 3 to 5 or 6, oh my God, this is the best stuff I've ever written. This is, you know, why doesn't the Nobel Prize Committee just call me up and we'll just take care of that now. The next morning, you get up and you look at what you did late in the day, and you can't believe the idiocy that you've managed to display and hope that no one ever wants to see. So it's in a way, it's a little like physical labor. You're only good for so many hours.
Yeah. So David Aldridge, you're a victim of, or you have to respond to the timing of events, a lot of them in the nighttime.
Got to write at night. Yep.
Is that your peak time?
Yep. Yep.
And then in the morning, what's your routine?
Can't function. Can't write in the morning. I can get up in the morning because we got kids, so you got to get up in the morning. But I can't physically face my computer until minimum 9 a.m. I just can't. I can't do it. I can't. I have nothing, no storage, nothing. It is totally that, Tori. I've been working nights for the last 35 years of my life. So
and do you
that's
have
when I can write.
I know some people, some of your colleagues would say they're covering whatever it is, basketball, and they get so into what they're covering, and it was a great game, and they just write the spectacular stuff, and then they're just wired, and they don't go to sleep.
No, you can't
3,
go to
4.
Sleep. That's why you see, well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why you see so many slovenly sports writers is because we don't get enough sleep.
We drink way too much and we eat terribly.
The word was invented,
slovenly.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. It's well earned in many cases. Although nowadays, a lot of sports really look like David. They take care of themselves. They go run and lift and stuff. So it's a different breed now, you know.
Okay, David Wright, Final Day. So I was talking earlier about you, young adult, nonfiction, historical fiction. How do you choose your subjects? I want to dig into the New Internationals in particular, but how do you choose your subjects?
That's another really good question. I'm not reflexively a writer. Like I really had to come to it. I'm not reflexively a reader. Contrary to what I just said, there's a part of me that's a little bit lazy, and I'm perfectly happy like turning on the TV and not doing a whole lot. But some stories just sort of, at a certain point, you recognize they need to be told. So like with the New Internationals, my mom's backstory was always intriguing to me. And then as it got more, as I understood it more and it got more complicated, I don't know at what point I realized I was going to write it, but it felt like it needed to be told. And so it's a little bit like that, you know, when I was living abroad in my 20s and, you know, I was playing in sort of the beginnings of football in Europe, and there was a real Keystone Cop element to it. But part of it, I was just like, you know, I don't think I've read that before. You know, I haven't heard this story before. So some of it are just stories like that. I also, when I decided I wanted to try to be a writer, I was like probably like a lot of young American male writers in particular, maybe of my generation, but I was reading a whole lot of Hemingway, and I was thinking, you know, you have to go out and have these adventures and create these stories to tell.
Oh, you had to live it.
But then when you start, you know, doing things that are, you know, a little bit adventurous, then yeah, you start wanting to tell those stories, you know?
Yeah. Jim Grady, okay. Hemingway.
You know, I liked him. There are a couple of things of his that I think are brilliant, but some of his work didn't appeal to me as much as I thought. I became a Steinbeck guy. You know, I found his work to be beyond engrossing. It would bring me in, and also, I loved, I don't know if you know this, but to write The Grapes of Wrath, he actually gave up a fairly good lifestyle and went with what was called the Okies and lived with them in abject poverty and, you know, oppression by often, you know, gun-toting badges. That just appealed to me, that made him something special. Mm-hmm. I wanted to try and emulate. That was one reason I was a muckraker for 4 years for Jack Anderson, was to go out and have those kind of adventures and, you know, to be in places that I otherwise would not have been able to do. But that little muckraking press pass allowed me to go into organized crime and to some civil rights efforts and political things.
Yeah.
And to be able to see and live that firsthand, and then to be able to turn that into fiction. Oh, I feel like I may be the luckiest person you have on the show ever. I completely get Hemingway, but I'm your stock Steinbeck guy.
So a couple months ago, my daughter Deb and I went to Key West. It's like a last minute thing. And we did a couple of the walking tours, and every other block it was Hemingway drank here. Oh, Hemingway drank here. Oh, Hemingway owned this bar here. And that was kind of his life experience, I think. Okay, David Wright Faliday, tell us about the new internationals. I'm really intrigued. Again, I read so much about it recently, but it sounds like, to your earlier comment, it sounds like your mother's life story was just waiting to be told. But tell us about Cecile and learning more about your mother's life. Tell us about the book.
So it's as a way to answer that, what I'm working on now is actually nonfiction, telling the story in a nonfiction format. Wow. My family's sort of memoir, biography, lack of a better term, because with the New Internationals, as a novel, I felt like it sprawled early and I was having such a hard time telling it because my mother's story was big like that. And so I ended up trying to understand who those characters were. My mother, my biological father, who was descended from the kings of Dahomey, my Kansas City father, and compressed them into a narrow time frame, 1947. Mm-hmm. But so the New Internationals is that a young woman who has just survived, you know, the Nazi occupation of Paris, a Holocaust survivor, and who in her sort of outrage and rebellion embraces, the sort of revolutionary moment that is happening. You know, she joins the Communist Party. Anti-colonialism is happening. There are a lot of Black GIs in Paris. She's embracing the jazz scene. She's searching for herself, but by not necessarily looking at her own past closely as the descendant of a very wealthy secular Jewish family, but by these other oppressed peoples. And so their point of connection is past and recent oppression, mm-hmm. and maybe ongoing oppression.
So I read somewhere, it might have been the New Yorker interview you did, it was fascinating, and you, for a while, you considered not having Cecile, I'll say, loosely patterned on your mom, not having her be the central character, and it was going to be the two guys, Sebastian and Mac, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you talk about that? And then I have a wild connection to The Crown, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's because, again, as the story sprawled, Cecile remained central, but I finished a draft in 2014 or 15 that was much longer, over 500 pages, and it was bigger in this way. And it circulated, and every editor rejected it on the one hand, but rejected it with a very similar sort of critique, and it all seemed to point to Cecile. And so part of my just sort of reaction was, I can't write this character. I didn't know if it was because I couldn't plausibly write a young woman. I didn't know if it was the time.
Did they tell you what it was about her and how you were writing?
As somebody who has gotten a whole lot of rejections, they never are that conveniently useful. You know, they're just kind of like, this is not working. And you kind of have to read between the lines. But it was clear between the lines that Cecile was not coming off the page.
Wow.
And so at the New York Public Library, I had a Coleman Fellowship, and a fellow, Matty Tien, suggested I write her as nonfiction, which is where that New Yorker essay came from. The suggestion was, if I could write my mom as nonfiction, then maybe I would understand the character better. And in writing her as nonfiction, I began to see the character better. But before that, that's where I came up with the idea. It was clear Cecile was going to be central, but I thought maybe it would be from these two male characters' points of view as they see her, And then through that sort of dual prism, her character would be constructed in that way, you know, in sort of the absences and the silences and what they saw and missaw. But I have to say, when I said that a little bit like that at the Coleman Center, and they all sort of laughed at me and said, no, that's stupid. You know, and that's when they gave me the suggestion to write her as nonfiction. So thank God. Yeah, thank God for Maddie Chen.
Here's the, because I can't write, but you people can. There's something really interesting about these black GIs in Europe after World War II.
I
read about it. Of course, I've forgotten it. But in The Crown, which is a wonderful series, there was a great, not inconsequential, and I think based on truth, story about Queen Elizabeth as a young girl going into the streets of London to celebrate VE Day or whatever it is. And she goes in and she's dancing with a black GI and has this incredible, brief, more than emotional, romantic, you know, hookup with this guy. And there's something to it. Mm-hmm. When I was reading the book, David, I just started like scrolling down, you know, the Google machine and finding stuff and going, wow, that could be a sequel to this one.
Should be.
Yeah.
I say that because my dad.
Yeah.
My dad got drafted in 1943.
Wow.
Trained in, because he was born, well, in 43, it was 44, because he was born in 25, right? So did the 6 months and he went to Germany after the war. He was in occupied Germany.
Yeah.
And he served in occupied Germany for 4 years. And then they said, do you want to reenlist? And he said, no.
I'm good.
If he had said yes, he would have gone to Korea.
Oh, yeah.
But he said no, and 6 months later, Korea started. So I think about this, David, all the time.
Yeah.
About my dad being from Tampa, Florida, being in occupied Germany after World War II, and what that must have been like.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can speak to France a little bit more specifically, but there's this, I have to suspect in Germany too, the way that, you know, Germany before Hitler, even as Hitler was coming to power, the way that young people were embracing jazz and, you know, modernism, modernism itself had an eye towards, Picasso has an eye towards Africa and blackness. And they tend to not necessarily see, honestly, the black people that they are in some cases fetishizing or just admiring in the ways that they are admiring them.
Right.
But there still is that admiration. And from the Black GI's perspective, and this was true of my Kansas City father, of Bayless Wright, you know, he grew up in real poverty in Kansas City, Kansas. You know, he's picking potatoes with his mother at a really young age, and he drops out of school. And he was a highly intelligent, keenly intelligent man, but no real opportunity. And when he joins the military and he's in Europe, he was there after the war. He was born in 30, I think. Mm-hmm. He was there after the war, and then he stayed in the army into the 60s. So he moved around a lot. But when he was in France in particular, it wasn't just that he was well-received. I think he also understood himself as a liberator, as mm-hmm. somebody who was oppressed. He was a liberator. He had rights and you know, status in a way that just was not true of his life and of his family's life. He's sending money home to Kansas City.
Yeah.
I just think it was just a stark, you know, sort of this versus that, that made it hugely appealing to him.
I think it's so interesting on so many levels. And we're just right here. We're figuring out David Reid Folliday's next book. there are so many interesting aspects of it. And then, you know, the cliche of post-World War II in Europe is everything was wonderful. Oh, you know, the troops came in, they liberated, everything's great. It wasn't. It was really, really hard for the people who were still there. I used to work for SAP, a German company, and got to know a lot of Germans. And if you were, a lot of people who worked for me, they're 30s, maybe early 40s. And if their parents were still alive and living in Germany, they were somehow part of the machine. And you know, getting to know these people and how they had to try to deal with that and how to wrestle with that is absolutely fascinating. But I think there are a lot of those untold stories, which are great. Here's my father. My father's slightly different experience. He had gone into medical school and decides that he's going to sign up for the army. And they're like, great, we need medics. And they accelerated med school. So say med school is 4 years, 2 years. Shipped him off to the Philippines, but a little scary. Okay. Okay, tell me a little bit of a process question, David Wright Folliday, but Talk about the paperback version of something. Because the New Internationals is out in the paperback now, I started looking this up. The numbers on successful paperbacks are really extraordinary, and it could really give something another life. Is that your experience so far?
I hope that's true. I have been so, like, the business part of it is not my strength. So the fact of it going to paper means that it, at least in my sort of, you know, facile understanding, that it sold enough copies that it's still, there's a life for it to continue.
Yeah.
And I hope that that is the case. I don't know more than that. I never ask for sales figures. I'm a little superstitious.
Wow.
Yeah, I just sort of hope it has legs and it continues to exist and there continues to be interest. And so I'm always thrilled when stuff like this happens and we can have this conversation. But
Jim Brady, are you on the business side of book publishing?
No. I mean, first of all, they don't want me over or David on the business side. And second of all that's going to do is make you worry and fret and feel paranoid and, oh, my God, why didn't I sell any books in New Jersey? You know, it becomes that crushes your creative side and puts you into a zone where you have absolutely no power and very little knowledge. So no, I love to hear that you made a bestseller list here and there.
Uh-huh.
That's great. But I can't get up, and I've known a few authors who get up and obsessively look at bestseller lists online every day.
And David Aldridge, what's your experience been with your best-selling book on the top 100?
Best-selling, don't go
basketball players.
It's not at all best-selling. No, I don't know any. I don't want to know. It's not my. I'm out of my depth on that. Like they said, it did very well for the type of book it was. I'm happy then. Like it's not a bestseller. We didn't have a third printing or whatever. Anything. It didn't go to paperbacks. So it's fine. It's okay.
Well, to make you feel better, one of the all-time worst books ever written, "Lipstick on a Pig," by yours truly in 2006. All-time worst books ever. The publisher Simon Schuster, my editor Dominic Anfuso, worst editor ever. But every month I'd get this big fat manila envelope in the mail. And it was all these things I did not understand at all, what this was. But I just kept flipping and going, zero was essentially the answer. This went on for 3 or 4 years. And I finally called them up. Dominic was like, wherever. I called him and said, please stop sending this to me. It's embarrassing enough. I don't need to be reminded of this every time that thing hit the front porch. It's terrible. Okay, David Wright, follow day. What is next? You're doing the nonfiction version. That's pretty fast.
Yeah, and it's really coming fluidly. And I use that word deliberately. It's not easy. It's not coming easily, but it's coming fluidly. I have the great good fortune. I mean, the base of the New Internationals was these letters my grandmother gave me between her and my mom.
Wow.
So I had this sense. And then as I was living in France in my 20s and I'm, you know, being embraced by my West African family, I'm beginning to know it. But that's the basis of the New Internationals. But since then, I've continued the research and just had some really good luck. As an anecdote, I hope I didn't mention this last time. I think it's happened since. But so I had to, as I began working on the nonfiction part, when I first started doing the research for the New Internationals, obviously there's the internet and computer, but Google is much less, just not like we have it today. And so there was stuff in this trunk of letters. Like there was this a copy of my mother's from 1952 address book. And I knew she had been involved with Présence Africaine at the very beginnings and things like that. But I remember 20 odd years ago looking through the address book sort of cursorily and going, you know, I recognize nobody's name. Like this is just, these are her friends. But as I was flipping through it again recently in the past year, and it's in a little bit worse shape and it's falling apart. So I'm putting it back together and I'm on the W's and Richard Wright is in her address book.
Whoa.
So I start looking more closely and I start Googling people. So in the New Internationals, I have that scene that opens where they go to a communist youth camp in the south of France. And I knew that story because my mom had told me a version of it at some point. And then with Tom, I understood that she had actually been to the youth camp was in 53 or 54 in Romania. And the person, so in one of the letters, it cites a person she was with, and I find him in the address book, and I Google his name, the second president of Senegal, 15 years later. Like her social circle is like all these people, you know? And so part of me is like going, this person whose life looks like this, for a brief time, she was the managing editor of Présence Africaine. She wrote a note in the address book. I just missed it the first time. Like, this is a person who ends up in Borger, Texas, 16,000 people, small town, West Texas, oil town in 1970 something, you know? So the story just is opened up in those
ways. Yeah. But the essence of the characters, I'm going to tie it back to the New Internationals. The essence of the lead figures in the New Internationals, you can sense some of that. You absolutely can. I think she was sending you secret messages somehow. Yeah.
Sometimes not so secret. Yeah.
All right, Judd Ashman, before we subject David Wright Folliday to and his wonderful book, The New Internationals, to 60 seconds more, do you have any really, you know, in-depth, because you worked really hard to get ready for the show, question?
just one question. I'm curious if all this writing and research about your mother's life has answered more questions, or has it deepened the mystery about her for you?
It's answered so many more questions, and in really interesting ways. She and her children, she and my big sister and my little sister and I were always really close, and she was not secretive, but she could not in this weird way recall or articulate with any specificity. And so in that way, I could always imagine Cecile, but I couldn't make her specific. And the added research made them all, you know, like I knew that my aunt Solange Valadé was Jacques Lacan's protege, but I'm coming across these interviews and things like that where I'm, you know, she was the first president. So one of the few women in the African Students Union that appears in the book, but it was actually more important than I represented in the book. She was the first president, and over all these men, some of whom went on to become, you know, political figures and whatever, because of her status, because of her stature, and because of her intellect. And all that is so much more specific and concrete because of the research. And this is why, in part, it feels like it didn't fit in the New International specifically. But those stories are just so rich. It just feels like nonfiction. It just merits more sort of exploration and sort of revelation. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Okay, so fantastic. And now we're going to subject it to 60 seconds more. And we'll go back and compare your answers to previous editions of this show. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Favorite childhood book?
Comanche and His Captain.
Don't know Comanche and His Captain.
No good reason for you to. And I was late coming to books, but I was in the fourth grade in the library in Lawton, Oklahoma. My stepfather was stationed at Fort Sill, and there was like, I think, a picture of like a, you know, like a Western soldier and his horse. And Comanche was the name of the horse of Captain Miles Keogh from Custer's battalion. So it's basically the Custer story, not told through the perspective of the horse, but with the horse sort of very central. The horse apparently was the only survivor of the battle.
As it should have been. Okay, what's one book you wish everyone would read?
Ooh, that's always such a difficult question. There's so many ones that are important and wonderful. Honestly, I always fall back on this a little facilely, but Beloved. Such a beautiful book, but it also tells such an important story, and from such a you know, the sort of history of slavery from that perspective, sort of from slavery through the Civil War into the Reconstruction, and the tremendous impact it had on Black folks broadly, but on America. I just think it should be required reading. I teach the course I mentioned before, Slavery and Identity. And we still, I'm saying that as a way to say, we still haven't reckoned with slavery, and we still don't know enough about it. So I'd say Beloved.
Agree completely with what you just said. And Beloved is a book, I think I probably read it 3 times. And you can go back and read it again and again and go, oh, I didn't get that the first time, which is pretty amazing. Okay. Are you a spreadsheet or a seat of the pants kind of writer?
I'm more of a spreadsheet kind of writer. Yeah, I get really afraid of afraid is too strong, but it's not completely off. But like the blank page terrifies me. Once I have words on the page, I can do stuff. But the blank page and not knowing where I'm going, yeah, I hate it. I hate that.
Okay.
Part.
Finally, three writers. You want to have the best dinner party ever with three writers. Who are they? Dead or alive?
James Baldwin, absolutely. Yeah. Toni Morrison, absolutely. The third, wow.
It could be a small dinner party if you just.
Yeah. Well, that's, I'm there's so many. I'm kind of drawing a little bit of a blank. You know, in a weird way, I am intrigued by Mark Twain. I mean, in all the obvious ways, but I feel he's a little bit like the whole controversy around Huckleberry Finn and how Jim is represented, which is absolutely real. I got real insight when I read him next to Joel Chandler Harris, who were doing similar things. They were trying to represent Black people in favorable ways. And Jim gets so much closer than Uncle Remus. So I think that Mark Twain is, I think he was getting close to something, and it just was also a victim of his times, right?
Yeah.
A product of his times.
Product's probably a better word.
Yeah.
David Wright Fowler, the body of work is amazing. We hope
you keep
doing it. The latest is The New International is now available paperback. Evidently, what I studied about paperbacks is you get whole new demographics of readers, because there are still people who say, I want something to read at the beach or on my trip or whatever, but they want a light, easy paperback. So best wishes for the New Internationals.
From your lips to God's ears.
Exactly. You've got to come back with the next one. Everybody, please go out and buy all of David's work at your favorite independent bookstore. We are back in a couple of weeks with a couple of nominations for The Pitch, the writing competition, and Burner. David Aldridge, Judd, or Jim Grady, do you guys know Burner?
No.
Oh.
Okay.
Enlighten us.
Very, very cool. Billboard charting rapper. An entrepreneur in the cannabis field, filmmaker, and he's got a book out. It is wild. Becoming a Legend, The $1 Billion Blueprint to Be a Whale in a Sea of Sharks. And the sub, because with nonfiction, you got the subhead, then you got another head. Get Rich and Leave a Legacy. But seems like a very, very cool guy. So be crazy. And then in a couple of weeks, Jim Grady's coming back with his new one, which will be fantastic. So, Claude, we know you're listening. Thank you, my friend. Good luck with everything going on there. David Aldridge, Judd, you're going to come back soon and talk more about the festival.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Everybody. Free parking, free attendance. Jim Grady, love seeing you. And David Wright Foley, thank you so much.
Thank you all. It's been really great.
Thanks, guys. Out.